thank you so much. It's such an honor and a pleasure to be with you here. Thank you, Pavlos, for the introduction and also the invitation to come here to be with you. I'm so excited about this topic tonight. I'd like to talk about how law serves as a teacher. You might have heard that law is a tutor, right? And you might have even heard the phrase that that politics is downstream from culture, right? You might have heard that. I actually think there's a reciprocal relationship, and I'd like to explore that relationship between law, politics, and culture in my lecture tonight. How is law a tutor, exactly? We can think of how there are many laws in the U.S. Code that shape our behavior, right? The tax code is probably the preeminent example of how the law can shape people's behavior. The criminal code, another obvious example. But I think that what we mean when we say that the law is a teacher is that it can actually tutor the public and cultivate a more virtuous society that helps shape our concept of the good, the just, and what is ethical behavior. Of course, even asking this question, how does law operate as a tutor, depends on the previous question, an understanding of what law itself is and how to interpret it. And within the broader legal conservative movement, there's actually some philosophical dispute about that. For several decades, one school of thought has argued that we must simply interpret the law according to its original meaning when enacted. And this school is broadly thought of or considered to be originalist or textualist. Originalism was a reaction to what the Warren Court in the 60s and 70s adopted as a liberal mode of interpretation, where judges often substituted their own vision of justice for what the law was, and the law became the political instrument of judges. So to constrain judges, the originalists argued, we should force them to adhere to original meaning. So that school of thought sometimes tends toward positivism, which is the view that law is simply a command that comes from a power that people are accustomed to obey, right? That was the definition given by the jurisprudence scholar John Austin. Or that law is a command that people in fact obey, which was the definition of law given by H.L.A. Hart. So on this view, people recognize that certain commands are law, and then due to that recognition of it as law, they follow it. Positivists would say that even though law should be moral, morality isn't logically necessary to be a command accepted as law. On the other hand, there are those who argue that if a command lacks morality, that law is deficient in some way. It lacks an aspect of lawness, so to speak. This is a natural law view rooted in the classical legal tradition that I understand some of you are studying St. Thomas Aquinas on law, and so you might be familiar with kind of this understanding of law. Augustine's famous line that an unjust law is no law at all is a somewhat pithy summary of this view, although perhaps a little bit overly simplistic. From a natural law perspective, human law is law insofar as it conforms to basic truths of right and wrong that are not only right for everyone, but at some level are known to everyone by ordinary exercise of reason. A good summary of this is found in the Federalist Papers, in Federalist 31, where Hamilton talks about how there are certain primary truths or first principles upon which all subsequent reasonings depend. These, he said, contain an internal evidence which, antecedent to all reflection and combination, command the assent of the mind. So natural law is law because it imposes an obligation upon us. And it's natural because it is embedded into the structure of the world around us and is accessible through reason. So a natural lawyer's adjudication might take into consideration facts of natural justice rather than mere authorial intent or original meaning. Right, so there's a leading case, well-known case called Riggs versus Palmer, the case of the murdering heir, where the principle is that one can't profit from his own wrong. This nephew murdered his uncle in order to inherit under the will. And the question presented to the court is there an implicit exception in the law of inheritance for someone who murders for his own gain, right? So the question is, did the original intent of the legislature have this sort of case in mind when it enacted the law? So in between these two poles of perhaps more positivist approach to the law and a more natural law approach to the law, we might find one synthesis, what might be called the natural law originalism or a common good originalism. On this view, we might make use of natural law reasoning to arrive at a political system that allocates lawmaking and law enforcing and law interpreting responsibilities differently, and reserves natural law reasoning in contravention of positive law to the former two institutions, right? The lawmaking and law enforcing institutions. So a judge wouldn't necessarily be allowed to rely on natural law reasoning to expressly contradict the legislature's enacted text, but would of course continue to use that natural law reasoning to analyze the issues. So as an example of this, we can think back to the anti-slavery judges or Lord Mansfield in England, who in these interstitial areas where the legislature had not spoken to the specific issue, so for example, in the law of the sea, is there a right of revolt among the enslaved people on a slave ship, right, against the captain and the crew who have kidnapped them, right? So in those interstitial areas where the positive law does not apply, natural reasoning directly by judges might still be applicable. No person can ignore natural law when any more than one could ignore the laws of logic. And everyone, including judges, utilize natural law in their legal reasoning to interpret a text within its permissible range of meaning and intent. So, for example, many historical questions, even on an originalist perspective, are close cases. If you're an originalist, how would you, as a judge, resolve a debated constitutional question when there's competing historical evidence on both sides about original meaning? A common good originalist, a common good constitutionalist, might argue that these particular contested questions should be considered within a broader context of our laws, including the stated purposes for which our Constitution was adopted and designed and enacted, or the principles of the Declaration of Independence that underlie it. Today I want to talk about a particular case in point that I actually do not think is a particularly close historical case, but I think it might provide a helpful lens through which to consider some of these interpretive debates about how we approach the Constitution and how we approach the study of law and the interpretation of it. I want to talk about the constitutionality of abortion, how constitutional adjudicators got an interpretive question wrong and miseducated an entire generation about both law and morality, about how the recent Dobbs decision was a step toward a proper interpretation of the Constitution and its protection of life. And finally, I want to, in this talk, I want to do three things. First, I want to analyze the Supreme Court's abortion jurisprudence leading up to the moment that we're at now. Second, I want to explain what I've called the constitutional case for life. And third, I want to outline some policy ways that the law can serve as a teacher as we move forward. Before we get into the historical jurisprudence of abortion under our Supreme Court precedent, I want to look at the text of the 14th Amendment itself, which is kind of the basis for all of these cases. So if you'll bear with me, we can open up to the 14th Amendment itself, and I'll read you part of the Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. So I've got it right here. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment, the first sentence says, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and the state in which they reside." So this first sentence is the citizenship clause. Now, a lot of people stop me right there because, you know, they know that I've argued before that the meaning of the word person in Section 1 includes the unborn, and they say, "Josh, you have to stop right there. The first few words are all persons born. So how could the 14th Amendment apply to the unborn?" Well, it's important to realize that this is talking about citizenship. This is the citizenship clause. All persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens of the United States. And not all persons are citizens. So it's taking this broader and undefined class of persons and narrowing it to its subset of citizens. Citizens are entitled to the privileges or immunities of citizenship. And so that's the very next sentence. "No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States." Now that's the privileges or immunities clause. Now we get into the due process and equal protection clauses. Now here the subject is no longer citizens. As you'll notice, the subject is persons. It says, "Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law," the due process clause, "nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws." So in Section 1, we have two things. We have a definition of citizenship and then securing the privileges or immunities of citizenship. And then we have a guarantee of due process and equal protection that sweeps broader than citizenship and includes all persons. Okay, so with that in mind, how did the Supreme Court reach its decision in Roe v. Wade, looking at the text that we just examined? Well, the 1973 Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade required states to allow abortion, and the seven men forming the majority said that the right to privacy includes a woman's decision to end the life of her preborn child effectively through all 9 months of pregnancy. Now, you might be wondering, wait, the right to privacy? We just read Section 1 and we didn't hear anything about privacy, right? Well, this was interpreting previous cases that had found in the penumbras of emanations from penumbras in the Constitution, this right to privacy that ultimately they said was rooted in the Due Process Clause. So that clause that said that the state shall not deny life, liberty, or property without due process of law. They said there's a substantive component to that clause that beneath which no state may go, and that substantive component includes a right to privacy that extends to the right to an abortion. So that decision was widely criticized, even by legal scholars who support abortion, right? First, on the basis that it did not contain a right to privacy and that this was an extension of or a misapplication of what due process actually required. Now, during initial arguments for Roe, Texas actually urged the argument that the fetus is a person within the meaning of the 14th Amendment. The Supreme Court, however, rejected Texas's argument and ruled, quote, that the word person as used in the 14th Amendment does not include the unborn. But Justice Harry Blackmun, who wrote the opinion, made an important admission. He went on to say that if prenatal personhood is established, quote, the case for abortion collapses, for the fetus's right to life would then be guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment. We'll return to that point in a little bit. But for now, it's important to understand that Roe set up this trimester framework under which states could regulate abortion based on a woman's health in the second trimester and regulate abortion based on the state's interest in the, quote, potential life of the fetus in the third trimester. But even those limitations ultimately broke down in a companion case to Roe v. Wade called Doe v. Bolton. And in that case, the court said that there's a health exception for the third trimester, and indeed throughout pregnancy. This health exception, however, is not just limited to, for example, the life of the mother, but it actually adopted this broad World Health Organization definition of health that included, quote, all factors, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age. So this definition of health was so broad that practically anything would fit within the health exception. And that's why in my home state of Colorado, it has been legal since then to perform abortions through all 9 months of pregnancy and including up until the day before birth. So that was Roe v. Wade. Now, in 1992, it looked like things might change. The court accepted a case that directly challenged Roe, and many believe that Roe would actually be overturned because between Roe and Casey, there have been several new appointments to the Supreme Court and confirmations to the Supreme Court from Republican presidents, and there was a hope that these new justices might actually vote to overturn Roe. But a majority of the court reaffirmed what they called the central holding of Roe, and the plurality of the court rejected that Roe trimester framework and its privacy rationale, but instead held that there exists a constitutional right to abortion based on the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause. So again, in that Due Process Clause, it guarantees the right to life, liberty, and property. No state shall deprive without due process of law. And they said inherent within that word liberty includes the liberty to obtain an abortion. The court established that states could regulate abortion after what they called fetal viability, so long as the regulation wouldn't impose an undue burden on women seeking abortion, and subject to the expansive health exception that I previously discussed. But this decision didn't make very much sense either. First, the evidence that abortion was historically considered a liberty, had been entirely debunked by this point. It had been discredited even among scholars who supported a constitutional right to abortion. Second, fetal viability is a completely arbitrary standard. It's a moving target based on medical technology, right? Now, babies, even at some at 21 weeks gestational age, have survived outside the womb as our technology gets better and better. So a viability line that makes factors that are constitutionally irrelevant, such as the state of our medicine, constitutionally decisive. That's what they did. Finally, much of the decision focused on the court's own credibility. So the justices refused to reverse course on Roe because they felt that doing so would be to admit that the court had made a mistake, which it was unwilling to do. So that brings us to Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. The case argued 2 terms ago, which is the most important Supreme Court case, I believe, of our lifetimes. Mississippi passed a law that prohibited most abortions after 15 weeks gestation, and it asked the Supreme Court to reconsider whether laws that regulate abortion prior to viability are unconstitutional. It argued that both Roe and Casey should be overturned, and it made many of the same criticisms that I've discussed here today. So after a dramatic and unprecedented leak of the draft majority opinion, the majority of the court stood firm. Now, this was unprecedented. A draft opinion of the Supreme Court has never been leaked like that before. Certain results had actually been leaked in the 1800s, and then again, actually, in Roe v. Wade itself, the decision, the verdict, was leaked ahead of time, but not the opinion itself. And in fact, most people, you guys are more educated than the vast majority of audiences and the public. You probably know that there was actually an assassination attempt against Justice Kavanaugh, where someone traveled across the country with the intent of trying to murder a Supreme Court justice to prevent this decision from being issued. But nonetheless, a majority of the court stood firm. And it held that 6-3 to uphold the Mississippi law and 5-4 to overturn Roe and Casey. So the majority opinion by Justice Samuel Alito held that the Constitution does not confer a right to abortion and that Roe and Casey were overruled. The court adopted a historical approach and examined whether the right to an abortion was rooted in the nation's history and tradition and whether it was considered an essential component of ordered liberty. The court found that, quote, the right to abortion is not deeply rooted in the nation's history and tradition. Until the latter point of the 20th century, there was no support in American law for a constitutional right to obtain an abortion. No state constitutional provision had recognized such a right. Until a few years before Roe, no federal or state court had recognized such a right, nor had any scholarly treatise. Indeed, abortion had long been a crime in every single state, end quote. Chief Justice Roberts, who would have upheld the Mississippi law but not voted to overturn Roe and Casey, wrote in his concurrence in the judgment that he thought that the viability line from Roe and Casey could be jettisoned without getting rid of abortion, the constitutional right to abortion altogether. Now, I think it's very important as we examine the majority opinion in Dobbs to note that 5 times the majority observed that abortion is, quote, critically different than any other right this court has held to fall within the 14th Amendment's protection of liberty, because it destroys what Roe and Casey called fetal life and what the Mississippi law calls an unborn human being. The majority opinion repeatedly distinguished other substantive due process cases. Those are the cases that are known for that substantive component of due process, right? Not just giving you process before depriving life, liberty, or property, but actually that there are fundamental rights that are protected by due process. And some of us in the Q&A earlier today with the seniors, we discussed how substantive due process is kind of the greatest hits of those cases began with Griswold versus Connecticut, right? The contraception case, Eisenstadt versus Bard, an extension of that case. Then Roe v. Wade, then Obergefell versus Hodges, right, the same-sex marriage case. So these are all in that same line of cases about substantive due process. And the majority said that it's different from all of those other cases because only in this case is there a third party being destroyed, the life of the unborn child. The majority repeatedly distinguished those cases on the grounds that, quote, abortion is a unique act because it terminates life or potential life. So I believe central to the Dobbs holding was the unavoidable fact that abortion takes a human life. So that point leads me to the second topic I want to address tonight, the central theme of my talk, which is going to be the constitutional case for life.
The argument that the Constitution, properly interpreted, actually provides the equal protection of the laws to unborn children and effectively prohibits abortion nationwide. Now, the court didn't reach this question in Dobbs because the parties didn't raise it, and the court didn't need to address it to answer the question that was presented. The question that was presented was, can states regulate or prohibit abortion prior to fetal viability? And to answer that question, they didn't have to reach this second question about whether states are required to prohibit abortion prior to fetal viability. But going forward, I think this is where the debate, nationally and at the state level, will be focused. So I've made this argument in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and others like Professor Robert George at Princeton and John Finnis of Oxford made this argument in one of the amicus briefs submitted in Dobbs. The structure of this argument is relatively simple. First, the 14th Amendment's use of the word person guarantees due process and equal protection to all members of the human species within the geographic and jurisdictional reach of our Constitution. Second, the preborn are members of the human species from the moment of fertilization. Therefore, the 14th Amendment protects the preborn from fertilization. Now, I don't want to spend too much time on the minor premise that preborn humans are biological members of the human species. But I'd like to stipulate that it's scientifically and medically well established that unborn human beings are members of the species Homo sapiens from fertilization. In fact, a recent survey of biologists found that 95% of biologists agreed, regardless of their view on abortion, that human life begins at conception or fertilization. And this was widely known even before Roe v. Wade. Dr. Bradley Patton of Michigan Medical School wrote in The Foundations of Embryology, the textbook that you would get in a medical school when you study embryology, he wrote, "The union of two such sex cells to form a zygote constitutes the process of fertilization and initiates the life of a new individual." As Dr. Matthews Roth of Harvard Medical School later said, "It's incorrect to say that biological data cannot be decisive. It is scientifically correct to say that an individual human life begins at conception and that this developing human always is a member of our species in all stages of life." But let's put a pin in that discussion and return to what this means for law. Regardless of what constitutional method of interpretation you think is best, I think there's a compelling case that the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause guarantees protections for the unborn and, in fact, prohibits states from legalizing abortion. From a living constitutional view, the story of our Constitution is a story of expanding rights to more and more members of the human family based on our broadening notions of dignity and equality. Right? On this view, right, typically espoused by judges from a more progressive strain, the violence of abortion is incompatible with what the Supreme Court has called the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. Or you might take a view from the classical legal tradition, which I expect is probably a little bit more supported and attributed here. As Justinian's Digest reminds us, it's useless to know what the law is without knowing the persons for whose sake it was established. So in this view, positive law about the meaning of persons should conform as closely to as possible to the reality, right, the nature of what human beings truly are, and justice, the duties that we owe to those human beings. In this talk, however, I'm primarily going to focus on an originalist perspective, which is to say the same historical approach to historical practice and tradition that the Supreme Court applied in the Dobbs decision itself. Using that same historical framework, I want to draw on three strands of evidence to support my argument. So first, we could look to dictionaries of common and legal usage from the time the 14th Amendment was adopted and how they defined person and human being. The original public meaning of the term person actually included every member of the human race. And furthermore, the use of the term person in statutes and cases referred specifically to the unborn in many instances. Second, we could look to the long history and tradition of the common law precedent and state practice leading up to the adoption of the 14th Amendment in the 1860s, which indicates that the unborn were considered legal persons. And finally, we could look third to the original expected application. What did the drafters of the amendment expect that their amendment would accomplish? This original expected application might not be conclusive of original meaning, but it's a good indication of what informed citizens, and indeed the drafters themselves, thought that their text, what their text would do. And in fact, it shows that they thought it applied to every human being without exception. So let's run through each of those points in turn. Starting with contemporary indicators of public meaning, like legal treatises and dictionaries. If we open dictionaries of common and legal usage from the time of the 14th Amendment's adoption, they treated the word person and human being interchangeably. So, for example, the 1864 edition of Noah Webster's Dictionary of the English Language defined the term person as relating, quote, especially to a living human being, a man, woman, or child. And the entry for human includes all those belonging, quote, to the race of man. No dictionary of the era distinguished or referenced birth or the status of being born in its definition of person, man, child, or human being. In legal usage, the term person also had expansive scope. Alexander Burrell's New Law Dictionary and Glossary from the 1860s defined person as, quote, a human being considered as the subject of rights and as distinguished from a thing. And that's consistent with Blackstone, for whom there's no distinction between biological humanity and legal personhood. You might be surprised to know that Blackstone's Commentaries on the Laws of England, which was a preeminent treatise at the time of the founding, right? Every member of the founding who was a lawyer, they would have likely had this on their shelf, right? If you crack open the first volume of Blackstone's Commentaries and turn to the first book on the rights of persons, what will you find? He actually begins his discussion of the rights of persons with a discussion of the rights of the unborn child to personal life and personal security. So for Blackstone, he declared that natural persons are such as the God of nature formed us. And he declared that life is a right inherent by nature in every individual, and it begins in contemplation of law as soon as an infant is able to stir in the mother's womb. And as many legal scholars have explained, this mention of the unborn child stirring is not designed to, it's actually designed to protect the unborn child's life as soon as it can be detected, and not to exclude human life from protection prior to that point. So it's actually proper to derive the principle from Blackstone and others that if life could be shown to exist, then legal personhood existed also. So now that we're equipped to understand that meaning, we can look back at section one of the 14th Amendment. They use that term person, right? Now, prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment, foreign nationals and Native Americans, for example, were considered legal persons. And even under the Supreme Court's decision in Dred Scott, which declared that a black American was not a citizen, it still treated the black American as a person. Now, abuses of personhood certainly happened, and indeed, you can look to the Virginia Supreme Court, which declared that in the years leading up to the Civil War that the black American slave was not a person, and that indeed he was a type of chattel property. So we see this on the state level, a denial of personhood as we get closer and closer to the eve of the Civil War. But even Dred Scott acknowledged the personhood of the black American slave. In fact, the term person has always been larger than its subset citizen, and the Supreme Court's interpretation of those two terms has always understood this. We can look back to an 1880s case called Yickwo versus Hopkins that reflects that traditional understanding, acknowledging that the due process and equal protection clauses apply even to non-citizens. Before we turn to the next line of evidence, I want to point out that whether the states historically believed that the unborn specifically were members of the human species actually doesn't matter so long as they believed that all human beings were entitled to protection under the 14th Amendment. So to borrow from Justice Scalia here, just as the freedom of speech protects movies and internet communications under an originalist interpretation of the Constitution, even though those technologies didn't exist in 1791, right when the First Amendment was adopted, the word person protects every member of the human species, regardless of whether individuals were recognized as such at the time of the amendment's adoption. Right? So the meaning of the relevant text wouldn't be evolving. It's simply being applied to a new set of circumstances or a new set of factual information. And in fact, I think this is actually a stronger case than the case of old text being applied to a new technology, because here we're just interpreting the text as applied to the same object, but with better information about the nature of the thing, of the person. of the human being. But as it turns out, the states actually did historically believe that the unborn were living members of the human species. And that leads me to my second line of evidence, which is the state practice and common law leading up to the amendment's adoption. So the English common law tradition that the colonies inherited and the states adopted at the founding consistently treated the unborn child as a person whenever it would be to his or her benefit. Based on authorities like Lord Cook and William Blackstone, as well as landmark English cases, state high courts in the years leading up to 1868 declared, in the words of Massachusetts Justice Shaw, that the unborn human throughout pregnancy is a child, and hence, under civil and common law, to all intents and purposes, a child as much as if born, end quote. That's from Hall versus Hancock. That was in the year 1834, right? So this recognition was already there in state high courts, even in the early 1800s. Now, common law, abortion was unlawful at all stages of pregnancy, and it was typically criminally indictable as soon as the child's life could be detected, right? Either once a child was quick, the original rule, which quick meant alive, so as soon as the child was alive, or at quickening, first perceived fetal movement, which was kind of a perversion of the original understanding of quick that developed in the early to mid-1800s. Now, the exact meaning of quickening, I think, is subject to some debate, but I think it's ultimately unimportant for this argument because, in short, some archaic views of human generation held sway even into the mid-19th century, and some of these misperceptions led courts to leave reform of these common law abortion offenses, right, to make an abortion indictable prior to quickening, left that to the legislatures. So even though every living embryo was a quick child, some courts used quickening, the first perceived fetal movement, as a useful evidentiary tool for determining whether the crime of abortion had actually taken place. Because you couldn't prosecute the crime of abortion without proving an essential element that actually had taken the life of an unborn child. And so this was used as evidence to show that the crime of abortion had actually been committed. Now, an embryologist in the 1830s proved that each human individual begins his or her life cycle at fertilization, the states actually rapidly discarded that quickening standard that precluded some forms of indictment prior to quickening in favor of the new medically accurate fertilization standard. And that was true both as a matter of common law and statutory history. So, for example, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled in 1850 that, quote, the moment the womb is instinct with embryo life and gestation has begun, the crime of abortion may be perpetrated. There was, therefore, a crime at common law. So reinterpreting the common law to find a crime even prior to quickening. An indictable crime. Now, this passage, I think, is indicative of the national mood in that era. And in the 1851 case, Smith versus State, the Supreme Judicial Court of Maine likewise upheld a statute that discarded that old quickening standard to allow indictability or before quickening in light of the new medical and scientific evidence. So by 1866, Chief Justice Tenney of the Maine Supreme Court could accurately report that the quickening distinction has been abandoned. This is a quote. The quickening distinction has been abandoned by jurists in all countries where an enlightened jurisprudence exists in practice. So all of this was taking place against a backdrop of statutory reform between 1820 and 1880, during which the states were codifying and strengthening their prohibitions against abortion, right? So during this time, there was a move away from having common law crimes to having statutory crimes that were actually written down in a statutory code within the state or the territory. So by the time of the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, the states actually widely recognized by statute that the unborn child was a person. So 23 states and 6 territories referred to the fetus as a child in their anti-abortion statutes. 28 listed abortion among the statutory offenses against the person, or a functionally equivalent classification within their criminal code. And in a particularly striking example, the same Ohio legislature that ratified the 14th Amendment in January 1867, just 3 months later, actually passed legislation criminalizing abortion at all stages, making it indictable at all stages, just 3 months later after passing the 14th Amendment. And in fact, the committee that reviewed that bill, which was composed of several of the senators who had voted for ratification of the amendment, they declared in their committee report that abortion, quote, at any stage of existence is child murder. This is strong language coming from the 1860s. Now, some legal scholars, like Yale Law professor Reva Siegel, have suggested that this trend was motivated by protectionism within the medical community, or distrust of women's reproductive choices, rather than by recognition of the unborn child's common humanity. But I think that view is inconsistent with the fact that anti-abortion statutes during this period actually increased the penalty for abortion if it were proved to have caused the unborn child's death, and a majority of the states in their statutes did so irrespective of the age of gestation. So many of the states deemed prosecution for abortion fatally defective if it did not allege the destruction of the unborn child. Let's move to the third line of evidence that I want to explore, and that's the anticipated application from the drafters, the people who wrote the amendment. And I think the framers of the amendment themselves certainly thought that their amendment required due process and equal protection for every human being within the Constitution's jurisdictional ambit. And while the intentions of those framers don't directly govern the meaning of the text, right, only the meaning of the words was directly applicable, not their subjective intentions, I think it's worth wondering whether this radically inclusive amendment can be reasonably interpreted to exclude a subset of individuals who we know were considered to be human beings at the time it was written, and who we now know more than ever to be members of the human family. So the primary framer of the 14th Amendment, a man named John Bingham, believed that the amendment prevented states from refusing, quote, any of the rights which pertain to common humanity. Senator Jacob Howard, who sponsored the amendment in the Senate, he emphasized that the amendment guaranteed even the lowest and, quote, most despised members of the human race the equal protection of the laws. During the congressional debates, Representative James Brown rhetorically asked, does the term person carry with it anything other than a simple allusion to the existence of the individual? So the drafters of the amendment carefully crafted this text to include all human beings within the jurisdiction of the Constitution, regardless of their origin or circumstance. And it's important to recall that the 14th Amendment was also enacted against a backdrop of private violence that we'll talk about in a moment. But it's certainly the case that, as Justice Hugo Black later put it, the history of the 14th Amendment proves that people were told that its purpose was to help weak and defenseless human beings. I think that the widely shared belief by the framers of the amendment sheds light on the amendment's public meaning at the time of its adoption. I think the 14th Amendment was meant to be a new birth of freedom for all human beings. Now, if you've taken any constitutional law class at this point, you might be wondering, where's the state action? Right? Typically, our constitutional rights are only enforceable against the government, not against private actors. Right? You can't sue Pavlos for violating your freedom of speech when he tells you to be quiet in the classroom. Right? Right? But when the state tells you that you can't speak or petition for redress of grievances, right, then you have a First Amendment violation. Now, the same is true that constitutional rights don't typically defend you against private actors in the due process context. A state's failure to protect an individual against private violence doesn't usually constitute a violation of due process. So even if the unborn are included within the meaning of the word person, how could it be that there's any state action that would make the 14th Amendment applicable? Well, the Supreme Court has long recognized that the state may not, quote, of course, selectively deny its protective services to certain disfavored minorities without violating the Equal Protection Clause. And that's completely consistent with the historical backdrop against which the 14th Amendment was adopted. Because one of the main things the 14th Amendment was meant to address was specifically the context of these extrajudicial killings, right, lynchings that were happening during Reconstruction, immediately after in the aftermath of the Civil War. So the amendment was specifically drafted to ensure that states couldn't withdraw the protection of the laws from some disfavored minority group while discriminating in their application of generally applicable homicide laws. Right? It would be a clear equal protection violation for a state to say, if the victim is Asian, or if the victim is female, right, then our generally applicable homicide laws don't apply, and you can commit homicide with malice aforethought. Right? That would be an equal protection violation. So Dobbs, when Dobbs held that there's no constitutional right to abortion, It didn't end the struggle toward recognizing legal and securing legal protection for the unborn, because it actually only corrected one of Roe's foundational legal errors. After Dobbs, I think litigation and legislation has to ensure the Constitution's guarantee that every person in the United States shall enjoy the equal protection of the laws, born and unborn. I want you to begin thinking of questions, because I'm moving into the third part of my talk here, and after that we'll take some questions. This leads me to, where do we go from here? After Dobbs, what does public policy at the state and federal level look like? Who decides? How do we enact this vision of the constitutional case for life? How do we secure equal protection for all? And I think each branch and level of government has a role to play. So at the state level, the states retain their primary duty to protect the inalienable rights of all human beings within their jurisdictions, the foremost of which is the right to life. So states actually have a duty and responsibility to exercise their police powers, right, their powers to protect public health, safety, and morals, to prohibit abortion. So state governors and legislators should do everything in their power to uphold the Constitution on this point. And many states are already doing that. We can talk about more issues with that in the various states in the Q&A. Many states are already acknowledging this equal protection obligation. At the federal level, each branch has a role to play. But let's start with Congress. Congress actually has an enumerated power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to, quote, enforce by appropriate legislation the Constitution's protections of equal protection and due process, including for unborn persons. So we've seen examples of this with the Life at Conception Act, for example, that specifically invokes the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause in its guarantee and prohibition of abortion nationwide. I recently co-authored an article in the Washington Post with Professor Robert George, kind of outlining the authority of Congress to pass such legislation, but it's really not a new idea either. Actually, every Republican platform going back to 1984, and this is not a partisan point, right? I'm not making a partisan point here. I'm just pointing out this is not a new idea. Every Republican platform going back to 1984 has called for, quote, legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to children before birth. And in fact, President Ronald Reagan was a big advocate for this, and in fact gave a personhood proclamation in 1988 acknowledging this 14th Amendment obligation. So that's Congress. Second, the judiciary. I believe the judiciary has an obligation to apply the original meaning of the Equal Protection Clause to decide whatever cases or controversies come before the court. And there's presently no binding precedent on the question of whether the unborn child is a person, right? Roe has been overturned, including the holding that the unborn child is not a person. So there is no binding precedent right now from the Supreme Court on that question. So courts are free to recognize the 14th Amendment's protections, just as a three-judge panel did in 1971 before Roe, recognizing that the unborn child was a person within the meaning of the Equal Protection Clause and striking down Ohio's permissive state law on abortion on that basis. Third, the executive should follow President Lincoln's example to assert departmental authority to interpret and uphold the Constitution. The president has, in Article 2, a constitutional duty to, quote, take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The president swears an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not necessarily, however, it's interpreted by the Supreme Court. There's an independent duty. Before you can faithfully execute the laws, you have to understand what they mean. There's an interpretive question, right? An antecedent interpretive question. And if it meant that when you swear the oath to uphold the constitutional office of the president, to uphold the Constitution, that you're swearing to uphold whatever the Supreme Court says, then Lincoln could not have sworn that oath of office. Because he argued that Dred Scott was an improper interpretation of the Constitution, and argued against this arrogation of judicial authority as the supreme interpreter of the Constitution, argued that he had an independent duty as a co-equal branch of government to also independent and execute the Constitution as he understood it. And so, in fact, Lincoln actually did this in examples such as granting patents to black Americans. When patents could only be issued to citizens, the Lincoln administration did so, notwithstanding Dred Scott. So within his departmental authority, the president has that power. Not outside of it, but within the agencies and departments under the executive branch. Another example, President Lincoln issued passports to black Americans even though Black Americans, you had to be a citizen to receive a passport. I wrote a paper on this called the Lincoln Proposal. It's published on the Americans United for Life website. So if you're kind of interested in that theory, you're hearing that for the first time, what the president also interprets the Constitution, you can look that up. It's called the Lincoln Proposal. You can read that white paper as well. And I think speaking of Lincoln, his debates with Stephen Douglas provide a helpful lens through which to view future debates over the constitutional right to life and states' rights. Right? So I know that you're going to be studying, some of you are going to be studying Lincoln in a few weeks here, but he had these famous debates with Stephen Douglas in the Senate race, right, in Illinois. And Stephen Douglas made the argument that slavery should be decided by each state or territory, and that the people should just vote up or down whether to support slavery or not. But I think Lincoln provided an important counterpoint to that view, arguing that a Democratic majority's authority is derived from nothing other than the equal natural rights of the persons that constitute it. So a majority cannot ignore and disparage the humanity of others without vitiating its own legitimacy and right to rule. No democratic process can legitimately deny those inalienable rights with which the Creator has endowed his children, the foremost of which is the right to life. And I think that here at WCC, it's especially appropriate to invoke the words of St. John Paul II, who observed that authentic democracy is possible only on the basis of a correct conception of the human person. A value-neutral majoritarianism, like the one espoused by Douglas, that ignores the rights of persons, he wrote, can easily turns into open or thinly disguised totalitarianism. So as we seek to build on the victory of Dobbs, I think we would do well to remember the words of one of Justice Robert Jackson's greatest Supreme Court opinions, in which he wrote that one's right to life may not be submitted to a vote. It depends on the outcome of no elections. The foundational error of Roe was not that it short-circuited the democratic process, but that it denied constitutional personhood to the weakest and most vulnerable among us. Thank you, and I look forward to taking your questions. Yeah, we'll go in the back.